accession number 23447, reel 4.
Mr. Waller, reel 4. We were on the Andes, December 1940. Yep. And you said you went on a dog leg.
Yep.
What's the next thing you remember of the voyage? What do you remember of the sort of events of that voyage, if there were any?
Well, when we got to the, shall we say, warmer climates, because bearing in mind, Scotland in December and the North Sea is not, and the Atlantic is not exactly a luxury cruise. We made our way out, pretty well confined, miserable. But then, I think it took about 8 weeks to do the journey. But after a couple of weeks, we started getting to warmer waters, and we were allowed out on deck. And bearing in mind that, pre-war, people of my age had never even been to France or anything like that. And there we were in foreign parts, sort of seeing flying fish come out of the water and dolphins and all this, you know. This was a wonderland as far as we were concerned. And we made our way to, the first stop was at Freetown, what was then the Gold Coast. We anchored. We didn't come off the boat. We anchored, and the natives in the bum boats came out, offering you bunches of bananas, and you were looking out over the side or out the porthole saying, "Here, cop it, he's swapping his spare pair of boots." Little did you realise that they were your boots that somebody had taken out of your kit bag. So, and of course there was the usual throwing the coins in the water, and they used to die for them, and this was all sort of wonderland, you know, to the likes of us. So we got to Freetown, and we stopped overnight, a couple of days at Freetown.
Didn't get ashore, though.
No, we didn't get off the boat. And then we moved on, and we must have come down the coast of Africa. Some of the convoys stopped off at Cape Town. We went on to Durban. So we pulled in at Durban, and told we were going to be allowed ashore. I, fortunately, a friend of mine, his auntie lived in Durban, and I had met her just before the war when she was over here, so I'd got her address. I thought, well, I'd go and visit her. But we were, it was the luck of the draw. The previous draft were taken off and put in a camp for 3 weeks. No, great. We were there 4 days. We got to, the first day we came off, we were wearing battle dress. It was about 90 degrees. We were warned about, don't go there, you know, the anti-apartheid, you know, blacks only and all that, and how they had to get off the pavement if you walked by. We found all this very strange. I went into Woolworths, looked around, and of course, although it might be a shop assistant in Woolworths, because she was white, you didn't employ blacks on that sort of thing. We got chatting, and she said, "Would you like to borrow my car for the day and drive around?" And I said, "Yeah." "Well, it's going to be an ordinary car." She gave me the where to pick it up, and it was a bloody going Buick. So my pal and I had a nice day touring around. And then we went out to this address, met the auntie, and we were invited in, had tea and all that. And, but we had, I say, we did the use of the car one day, and with this, my pal's auntie the next day. And that was our 2 days. The first day we went ashore, we had battle rest. Second day, we had to put on KD. And there we were amongst all these bronze South African troops with our white knees, white thing. And they had these little dinky shorts, and we had the old Bombay blue, and we felt right Burks. So, then we left, came back, and the Andes was going back, and we were going on. This is why we only got three days there. The New Amsterdam had come from Egypt, so it's bringing Italian POWs back to Durban, where they were going to put in camps. We got on there, and they weren't the most hygienic people, the Italians. Bloody beds, bunks stunk, the blankets stunk, they'd crapped all over the place and everything, and it was filthy. And I mean, they got them off, and I thought there was going to be a mutiny then, because the English troops went on and walked out and said, we're not getting on there. And that's how we got the extra day. They had to spend the day cleaning the ship up before we could get on to take us on, because, oh, it was a filthy state. So we left Durban, and then we went on, of course, to Suez, you know, up the Red Sea, and got off. What's at the end? I'm trying to remember which. It was,
I can't remember, Port Said or Port Tewfik.
Yeah, that's right, we got off at Port Tewfik, yeah. And where lorries were waiting for you, and then they took you to Geneva, or the which was the base camp. And you went there, where you were allocated, you know, according to you were in bell tents, they had bell tents, and you were allocated a tent. And you start, the idea was that you had to spend a couple of weeks there to get acclimatised to the heat and the sun.
How did you find the heat and the sun? I mean, you know, I mean, you'd been coming out on the boat, but how in the desert, how was it?
Well, it was bloody hot, you know, it really was. And but strangely enough, despite the heat, nobody wore a topi. They didn't like them, they were horrible. So you put them down near the wheel of a truck and hope you drive over it, and that was an accident. You didn't have to pay for a replacement, you see, as long as you could lose it. But you were warned, I mean, straight away, you know, that be careful, don't take your shirts off and things like that, because you'll be sunburnt, you know, and you were careful, but it was surprising how quick you went from red to brown, you know. And while we were in Geneva, they took you out on training in the desert, you know, well, the nearby desert. So you got used to driving a 1500 weight.
What was it like? I mean, what did you have to learn to drive a 1500 weight in the desert? What was it? How was it different?
Oh, watching the sand, really, because there were only two-wheel drives and they were rear wheels, and as soon as you got on a bit of soft sand, you sunk in, and there you were, you had to dig them out, you see. So you got your basic of watching the sand, because a lot of people think the sand is just like Bourges, you know, rolling, but it's not. In places it's rock hard, and other places where you could, if you take the wrong track, you break your springs. The next one, you can go on soft sand and sink in the desert. So it was a question of learning how to do it. A bit on the maintenance, because of boiling over and keeping the sand out of the engine and things like that. And then I was put on a carrier course then. And this was
while you were at Geneva.
Yeah.
So what were you learning on that? I mean, you'd already driven the carrier, hadn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. But the difference is, to give you an idea, when you're driving it, if you got chucked the sand in the wrong way, you know, where it was undulating, the damn thing would dig in like that and suddenly turn over. You'd be left inside upside down in a carrier. Which was all right for the driver, because the steering wheel was across your lap and that held you in, but the Bren gunner sitting next to you didn't. And, so really it was to get you used to the conditions, you know, the land condition, driving on the sand that you were doing. But it was a bit short-lived, because there was some scare that parachutists were going to be dropped down in the Delta, and there was some dumps, ammunition dumps, food dumps. So we were sent to guard and I suppose during that time was must have when I didn't realise I must have got bitten by a mosquito, or a few mosquitoes. So I come back, I did my stint, come back, I'm driving.
Yeah. What was it like guarding the ammunition ship? I mean, what exactly were you doing?
Well, I mean, just patrolling round the wire of the dump, you know. That's all you were doing, you know, the usual two on four of patrolling round the wire.
Did anything ever happen?
No. No, I think it was a full scare, but they took it seriously, and because we were only sent down for a few days, you know, and then word came through, no, it's all right. So we went back, and I went back onto the carrier, and I'm driving, and it's thumping head. God almighty, I hope. It was really like somebody was hitting with me a hammer, you see, and I sort of, and the bloke said to me, he said, "Where are you driving?" He said, "And he's going all over the place." So I stopped. He said, "You better go to sick bay." So I went to sick bay, and I came out there. And I remember the nurse was just coming, kept sticking needles in my thumb and taking little drops of blood. And she came out and said, "Oh, it's all right. You've got malaria." So right, go into the hospital. Now, this was on the Friday morning. And I can remember one thing. Waking up in the hall, he said, "You know, is your meal?" And I said, "Oh, I don't want to eat." He says, "Chicken?" I said, "I don't care what it is. I bloody don't want to eat." Anyway, I sort of went off to sleep, and I came to, and there were two of my pals sitting there, one of them being the barrow boy. And I said, "God." I said, "I feel bloody rough." He said, "Well," he said, "we thought we'd pop in and see you." I said, "Oh, it's very nice." I said, "How'd you get off, you know, Friday?" He said, "What do you mean Friday?" He said, "It's Sunday night." So I'd been out since Friday morning, come to on Sunday night, and they were sitting there. I remember that. And then, like, whenever you're in hospital, you don't bloody want a bloody jar, you know, you want to get up and go to the loo. And I said to the suit, "Can I go down?" She said, "You can get up for 1 minute." You're joking. End of a half a minute, I was on my knees, I was crawling. So I spent, I think, was it a week, 10 days, you know what I mean, in there. And then a push had started, so the casualties were coming back. So they wanted a bed, so I was shoved out of hospital, and they said, "Well, you really should have convalescent. But what you do," there were two of us, and they attached us to, I think it was a KRR sergeant, and we used to do police patrol around Ismailia or Ismailia. And that was my convalescent, walking around with sidearms. He had a revolver, and the two of us had sidearms, you know, bayonet sword. And we used to walk round, and it was a good convalescent because you stuck your head in a bar or a restaurant, and they used to, "Oh, come in free," because they knew if they didn't feed you and drink you, that if there was any trouble, you'd go the other way. And they didn't want their place smashed up by drunken soldiers, so it was a sort of protection racket, and that was my convalescence thing.
So then you went back to Geneva?
Yeah, I went back to Geneva, and then up the blue, as they used to say, sent up to me.
That was when you were posted to the 9th Battalion?
Yeah.
And when did you join them? Do you know what date you joined them at?
Not offhand. I might be able to find it. But
do you know roughly?
No.
So where were
March,
they?
March, April, something like that. See, the 9th Battalion had been out there. They had been sent up to El Agheila.
Up to where?
El Agheila.
How do you spell that?
It's E-L and then A-L-G-E... L-I-A or something. It's El Agheila. And that, well, to give you an idea, it was the first time, see, the Africa Corps had come out. They hadn't been involved up to then. And so the British had been pushed up as far as Alleghelia, which they were saying Jews there, and it was a good place that you could hold. 9th Battalion was sent up there, and Rommel and his Africa Corps came down. It was their first thing. So that was their first introduction. Rommel charging at them, and they took a bit of a hammering. So they came back to the next stopping place, which was round about El Adam or somewhere like that. And
is that where you joined them?
Yeah. And by then, they had about 40-50% casualties, and they needed reinforcements.
And El Adam's the airfield area of Tobruk.
Outside Tobruk, yeah.
And roughly speaking, March 41.
Yeah.
They couldn't have been too far into April, because
yeah.
they were encircled.
Quite, yeah. April. And what they were doing, they came back to El Adam to sort of get some reinforcements, and there were big dumps of the old square petrol tins were piled up there with camouflage nets on. And it was a job to sort of keep an eye on. And that was my first job in Africa, was these damn things, you know, when you put them on the lorry, these tin tin cans used to leak. So they piled them up, and what you used to have to do was go around and keep lifting them and shaking them and find out which were the leakers. And then if a lorry came down and wanted petrol, because it was all high octane, wanted petrol for the tanks or anything like that, then you give them the leaker and say, oh, use these up, you see. Or, and that was really what... It was a rest period after the initial attack.
Did a lot of them leak? What?
I reckon we must have lost 30 or 40% of our fuel through leakers. It's terrible.
Was it just the seams weren't very good? Or the
yeah. You see, they used to put them on a lorry and bumping about on lorries, you know. I mean, they come over by ship, obviously.
And you were guarding the petrol dump?
Yeah, and they had these big dumps, you see.
Now, what were your first impression of the 9th Battalion when you joined them? How were you taken in, and, you know?
Well, all you were taken into was a section of six blokes.
And which platoon and company?
I was in B, 5 Platoon B Company. And, you know, you never got together very rarely as a platoon, let alone a company. You just went with a section. And that's how you were fed, you know. You took a sandbag and
How did you fit in? Who was in your section?
I'm trying to think of his surname. It was a corporal in charge, Jock. I know he was a jock, but I can't remember. Hutchinson, Jock Hutchinson was his name. And
what was he like?
He was very pleasant bloke. I mean, a bit like me, he was a territorial, so, you know, wasn't a regular army chap. They were all territorials, you see. And there was him and four or five other blokes. Four, that's right, and I made up the six.
And what were they like? How did you get on with them?
Well, I mean, because they were fairly new themselves, so, you know, they weren't sort of coming the old soldier or anything like that, you know. They came in, got up there, and suddenly got knocked back, so they were keeping a bit quiet, you know, nothing to boast about, and they just took me on. And
were you defending El Adam Airfield, or where were you? Just in the
they pulled back, and... There was no real defence. It was a question of, because of the casualties, and it was re-equipping, getting some reinforcements, and giving us a job.
You see, were you actually on El Adam Airfield? Or
yeah, I mean, yeah. And then
were you digging in at all, in basic defensive positions?
Yeah, I mean, your normal slit trenches because of air raids, or in case.
Well, tell me about the slit trench, because how did you dig a slit trench in the desert?
Obviously, just got a shovel, marked it out, sort of 3 foot wide, about 5 or 6 feet long, so you could, depending on your height, so you could lie down. and usually we used to dig them about 3 or 4 foot deep, you know, as long as you cover from there. And it depended on the ground. If it was soft sand, that was very soft sand, was a damn nuisance, because as you dug the hole, it ran back, the sand ran back in. If it was firmer sand, you were right. If it was rocky, I mean, I've known, particularly back at Alloway, where you needed engineers with pneumatic drills and dynamite to blow because of the rock. But basically, that was standard procedure in the desert. Whenever you stopped, you got out, and the first thing you did was start digging a slit trench.
Would you lay them out in any particular fashion, or were they just higgledy-piggledy?
No. Unless you were in a defensive position. If you were on column work and you stopped, or you've been pulled back like guarding the dump, you just chose whichever. You more or less said, oh, well, I'll dig it here and dig it there. And you picked the best ground to dig in rather than the best defensive position.
So you dug in a ladder. You just dug a slit trench for yourself. And what was the sort of routine of life for that first bit of El Adam?
Well, I say it was almost a rest, R&R, rest and recuperation period. But having said that, the company commander came round, drove round checking sections. Oh yes, you've got some reinforcements. Good, you've got some. And he then fell in. He said, "Fall in." And bear in mind that because of the marching pace, normally pre-war, Rifle Brigade didn't recruit anybody above 5'6". Conscripts were a different matter. So there was I. He came round and the company commander said, right, line up. And he came up and he picked myself and another tall chap. He said, right, you're going to be anti-tank gunners. We said, oh, yeah. So we were sent down to Tobruk to work on 2-pounder anti-tank guns. And we were firing at some knocked out, burnt out Italian tanks. Now, the reason we're tall, bloke, with a 2-pounder, you got it off a port, what they call pool tee, that was what, it was on the back of a, like a 3-ton, I think. And you got it down. And what you had to do was you had a big iron steel rod. You put it in the wheel, and you had to lift it up, release the cap, take the wheels off. And that's why he picked the tall chaps, because the little ones couldn't get it. It was difficult to get them up. Tall chap could get it up. So that was my qualification as an anti-tank gunner. I could lift it up high enough to get the wheel off. We were told about it. We spent 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon explaining, this is where you sit, this is a site, this is how you get it off.
How many in the, what was the sort of gun drill? What did everybody on the gun do? How many were there on the gun, and what did each one of the crew do?
Well, you had a number 1, 2, 3. Now, your number one was your NCO or officer who would be looking with his binoculars to pick your targets. Your number two would be your loader. Your number three would be your layer firer. And on a 2-pounder, he had a little seat. And you put your eye right against it because it was about 6 inches long of rubber, concertina rubber, and you rest your eye on it and then pull the trigger mechanism and fire. But the, as I say, it was really a question of, you were the number one was given the training, right, well, there's your target, you know, he had to estimate the range and these knocked out tanks, they weren't moving. And then the number three, he would get the orders and he would be looking through the thing and altering the elevation. And the number two, pushing the round up the thing. And as soon as he'd loaded, he would tap the number three on the shoulder. And he would fire.
Now, would you all practice on 1, 2, 3? You know.
Yeah, I mean, It's only one afternoon. I mean, we only fired about two rounds each. It's quick. That was it. And then they said, right, you are now anti-tank gunners. We went to a little way away when they had these damn things, collected this pool tea, which I say like a three-five tonner. We had it on the back. And he collected this, took it back, handed in our 1,500 weight truck, and we were anti-tank platoon. We were converted to an anti-tank platoon. Number 5 platoon was then converted. And you have 4 2-pounders.
But he was still with B Company.
Oh, yeah. B Company was turned into support company, you see.
What did you think of the 2-pounder anti-tank gun? I mean, you hadn't had much chance then, but, no. But what did you think of it as a gun?
All I can remember was the chap was in my lot when we were training, when we were firing him outside Tobruk. He said, he's no bloody. He said, all right, firing at a burnt out, knocked out Italian tank. He said, they won't stop a bloody. And he was a real dismal Joe, you know. And I thought, what he was telling me, we hadn't got a snowflake chance in hell, you see. He said, oh, they're not powerful enough. And he was right. But thank God we never used them in action. We got back and had them. And then after Knightsbridge started, we're saying, go over there. Suddenly somebody said, take your gun back, you're going to change it for a 6-pounder. So we hadn't actually fired a 2-pounder. We took it back and got a 6-pounder. Which caused us a number of casualties, because unlike the 2-pounder where you sat on a seat and you had a concertina rubber thing to put your eye on, you just had a metal sight on the 6-pounder. And when you fired the first shot, it almost reared off the ground until the thing dug in. Well, of course, we had no training. They just gave them to us, and I said, Knightsbridge was already going on. And because people put their eye against them like that, and as soon as they pulled it, bang, we lost about three number threes before we even saw the enemy.
I just want to make clear that that was a year later.
Yeah.
That you got the 6-pounders at Knightsbridge.
Yeah.